When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Image, and this is Skylines, the Cinemetric Podcast. This is a sort of live episode you're about to hear now. A couple of weeks ago, I was lucky enough to chair an event at the Cambridge Literary Festival with someone I really admire, the journalist and novelist John Lanchester, who writes for the London Review of Books, among other things. He was mostly there to promote his latest novel, The Wall, which is a sort of post-apocalyptic climate novel about a Britain in which climate change has happened. The world is basically screwed. And Britain's response has been to build a massive wall around the entire island to try and keep foreign people out and to force young people to spend 2 years standing guarding that wall. Whenever anyone from the outside world manages to breach the defences, some of those young people are put out to sea in exchange. It's a terrifying novel, in large part because of its banality. It's like, you know, it's a genuinely convincing vision of Britain's future with all the sort of, you know, climate apocalypse and generational conflict that implies. But it's also terrifying because it's kind of so normal. Just like, you know, it is very clearly recognisable as this country, even though it's basically a fascist government with, you know, slavery's come back and all this stuff. Anyway, it's a fantastic book, and John Lanchester is sort of a professional hero of mine. So it was really nice to get to share this event with him. And also, you know, it's really nice when you meet someone who's a bit of a hero and they turn out to be a completely lovely man as well. So, you know, before we were waiting to go on, we did have a fairly lengthy conversation about Game of Thrones and what we expected to happen in the final season, which is now showing, which you can probably tell as you listen to this conversation, because there's about 10 minutes where I totally lose control of it and we just talk about Game of Thrones in front of an entirely baffled audience of 60-year-olds who've clearly never seen a single minute of it. I've been meaning to get John onto the podcast for a while, actually, not just to talk about The Wall, but also because he's written in the past about The Tube, he's written about the housing crisis and capital and so on. So I thought it'd be a really great interviewee. And when I was invited to chair this event, I just checked, you know, would you mind if we recorded it and put it out as a podcast to save it from the same conversation again? So that's what you're going to hear now. It's just the entirety of our conversation at the Cambridge Literary Festival. One other thing before the podcast begins, I should thank the absolutely wonderful Agnes Frimston from the Chatham House podcast Undercurrents, who was kind enough to accompany me to Cambridge and keep me company. I really appreciated the support and having a friendly face in the audience. So thank you very much, Agnes. Without any more slightly self-indulgent thank yous, let's go talk to John Lanchester.
Well, hello, everyone. Am I audible? Can I be heard? Excellent. That's always a great start to these things. I'm delighted to be here with John Lanchester, who, as I'm sure you know, is the author of 5 novels, I believe, multiple non-fiction books, former deputy editor of the LRB, and whose current novel is The Wall, which is, how would you describe it? It's a post-environmental catastrophe dystopia sort of thing, but also about modern Britain. Is that reasonable?
Well, I'm always a bit wary about describing it myself because it gets described back to you so much. The word that keeps being used is dystopia, which wasn't at all in my mind when I wrote it. Cli-fi, that's one. Near-fi, that's near future. haven't had lo-fi or hi-fi or any other fis, but those are the main ones that keep coming up.
I mean, the thing that really struck me about the book is it is, although it's set in this kind of totally devastated world where the entire country has a wall around it. Sorry, no spoilers. This is all very much in there on page one. It is still very recognisable as this Britain. Like, you know, people do still kind of, you know, young people get pissed on trains to kind of, you know, let off steam and go on walking holidays in the Lake District and so on. And it's quite a sort of banal vision of the end of the world in some ways, isn't it?
Well, it's a funny thing. If you're writing in an altered reality about, I mean, so the novel, the premise of the novel is about catastrophic climate change, meaning a world about 4 to 5 degrees centigrade warmer, which unfortunately is, broadly speaking, the one we're on course for, according to the International Panel on Climate Change. So the sort of central thread of the IPCC predictions is about 3.7 degrees of warming, plus or minus 2 degrees by the end of the century if we don't change. So we're on course for this catastrophically altered world. And I almost took it. Well, I haven't used words like dystopia myself because I almost thought of it as being more like a sort of non-fiction, that it's a sort of non-fictional premise. Because I didn't write the IPCC report, you know. I sort of took that as the central strand of it. And then the process of writing the book was imagining the consequences, imagining what it would be like, trying to kind of fill in the detail and the texture of what that society was like. And one of the things that occurred to me in this sort of catastrophically altered world is, you know, people in a dystopia don't wander around saying, "God, I feel really dystopian today. How about you?" Just, "Yeah, I'm dystopian as well." Yeah, Nigel's looking incredibly dystopian. You know, that, you know, the texture of life is still the texture of life. And one of the ironies about Britain, there's a ranking, there's a kind of league, very dark league table of countries that have historically benefited most from CO2 emissions, on the one hand, correlated against countries least likely to be impacted by CO2 emissions. And the people who have benefited least and will suffer most are the global poor, concentrated around the tropics, because they don't emit much and they're going to be hit first. And the country that has historically benefited most and will be impacted least is Britain. So I did want to have recognisable continuities and things that people could identify with and recognise in order for the strangeness to seem stranger. You have to have a kind of balance between, you know, otherness and peculiarity and things that people recognise.
Let's take a step back. What was it that made you want to write a book effectively about climate change and the effect it might have? What was it that made you sort of feel that was a kind of fertile ground for fiction?
In a sense, I didn't want to write it. I was part of the way through another book. I was part of the way through another novel, and still am. Exactly the same point I was. And this is in early 2016, and I started having... the genesis of the book was very odd for me. It's not like anything else I've ever written. It was from a dream. It was a recurring image I had over a series of nights in the kind of liminal state between wake and sleep. And it was about a figure standing guard on a wall, on his own in the cold and the dark, and on the other side of the wall, the water lapping on it. And I sort of could sort of put myself back in the dream. I can sometimes do that as I'm falling asleep, sort of reimagine being in the same place. So that happened over a series of nights. And then I started wondering who that person was, and then actually quickly realised that's the wrong question, that the interesting question was what's happened to the world, because I could tell it was an altered world, and then realised that actually what I was doing was imagining a world after catastrophic climate change. And so the kind of premise of the book arrived completely out of the blue. If you'd said, "What's on your mind?" I wouldn't have said climate change. Mm. And then the process of writing it was one of sort of slightly, unpacking or unfolding or thinking through what the world would be like, and then, in a sense, the story of the book takes you through the world. The story of the book is a sort of exploration of that world and what it's like to live in it. And as I say, it was a really odd process for me. I've never had anything like that happen before. You know, image, character, world, story. It was a really strange sequence. I met the American writer Garth Riske-Hallberg a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying his theory is that every writer gets one book from a dream in their career, and I think I just used mine up.
So you have to start looking elsewhere for them, I suppose.
Well, Terry Pratchett used to talk about this warehouse called Ideas R Us.
Have you done much work on climate change before? Like, is it a long-term interest of yours? Or did kind of the urge to write about that also sort of pop into your heads?
I wrote a longish thing about it in 2007 after one of the IPCC reports, and then that big thing, I've forgotten the name of the chap who did the Brown Report on the kind of economics of how it was basically much cheaper as well as morally the right thing to do to start addressing it now, which had no effect at all, of course. But so I was on top of the science then, and I have kept sort of abreast of it. But the thing about it, I find it very difficult to think about. It's a very difficult subject to face. It's a very difficult subject to sort of make yourself look at. I often think of that thing La Rochefoucauld, the French aphorist, said that death, like the sun, cannot be contemplated directly. You can't look straight at it. And I think climate change is a bit like that, I think, for a lot of us. So big, so overwhelming. It seems to offer so little scope for individual agency. You know, it's actually hard to think about. And I think in a way what happened, that's exactly why it came out of a dream, you know, that because on some sense I couldn't bear to think about it. And yeah, in another way, it sort of was on my mind. It just wasn't on my conscious mind. And that's why, I sort of squished it down so much, it came out this other way.
It does sort of feel like one of those topics that, like, a lot of people are deliberately not looking at and kind of quite consciously not thinking about it as much as they probably should be, because it is too big and too terrifying to sort of contemplate, you know, effectively the end of the civilization we know.
And I think I completely agree with all of that, and I think there's a particular point about agency. I think we like stories to be about people who do things, you know, and I don't want to sound all Hollywood and hero's journey and all that, but by and large, we like stories to be about people who make decisions and act and, you know, change the world around them is changed by their actions and they're changed too. And with these huge structural and thematic stories, it's the thing I noticed with my previous book, Capital, that it's actually quite difficult to make stories with kind of economic context and backdrop, because a lot of the scale of the forces are so big, don't seem to offer much opportunity for individual agency. As the thing when I was starting to think about Capital, starting to write it, I remember hearing on some radio program, it was the wife of a firefighter, and he'd just been laid off due to austerity, just lost his job. And she was saying, I just want someone to tell me what did we do wrong? What should we have done that was different? What was the mistake that we made? And the answer to that was nothing. You didn't make a mistake. There was nothing you could have done differently. You know, because in a sense it wasn't up to you. You had no agency. And we hate hearing that. We hate hearing that actually we have no agency. And I think one of the reasons that climate change has this feeling of being something that we ought to think about but in some sense can't bear to, I think it touches on that. It touches on that sense of, you know, as we're, even if we did something, it would be nothing.
And I think that does sort of bleed through into the narrative, in that your protagonist is not, he's not massively active. He's kind of sort of shunted from place to place. Things sort of happen to him rather than being a result of his choices. Was that deliberate on your part, or did it just kind of feel like that's how it should
be? No, I wanted to write about a world where people didn't have any agency, where the agency had gone. Partly because actually I think the opposite to what I just said, actually we do have agency now, it's just we're not aware of it. And it's to do with acting collectively and at scale. And this is a world after that. You know, the disaster has already happened. And really the only choice they have left, the only choice they have in the novel is whether to have children or not, which is described in the book as being breeders. And that's one of the ways of getting off the wall, where they have to do this. They have to do this two-year term of, in effect, national service, standing guard on the wall. And one of the ways you can get off is by having children, but people don't want to do it because they don't want to bring children into the world. And I was aware of it as I was writing it, that that's actually about the only choice they get to make.
And I mean, I think that's one of the, I mean, we've been talking about it as an environmental book, and it obviously is in terms of the setting,
but also it's sort of a book about how something that is recognisably this country would deal with that kind of crisis. And I wonder if, like, again, you can sort of feel like other events sort of breeding into that, like the sort of Mediterranean migrant crisis seemed to be in there. Maybe there are even echoes of Brexit and so on. Was this something that you were conscious of, that you were sort of like, were you taking that kind of inspiration from like how the government was dealing with current events?
Not consciously, but you know, all sorts of things leak into books while you're writing. And funny enough, I've been more aware of it since I finished. I've been thinking about that very question. And although the migrant crisis was the thing that had immediately happened, a kind of memory that came back strongly was like I grew up in Hong Kong, and in the 70s in Hong Kong, a huge thing there was the what's now referred to as the boat people, the people fleeing Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos after the end of the Vietnam War. And that was a huge, huge thing. My last summer in Hong Kong, 1979, I did some volunteer work in one of the camps where they were mainly from Vietnam, they were being held. And it made a powerful impression on me for all sorts of reasons. One of them was that you had these children being held in a camp. And Hong Kong was a society built by refugees. It was built by people who'd fled communist China. And yet, the attitudes to people fleeing this other great crisis weren't at all accommodating. It was a very strange dual thing. And all the people who should be well-placed to understand it, actually, there wasn't much empathy. And the other great thing about that is that I remember at the time people saying, but, you know, how can we take, we can't take in thousands of people. It's tens of thousands, actually. It's hundreds of thousands. But actually, in fact, that's what the developed world did. Yeah, we took in 2.5 million. Mm. 2.5 million boat people were resettled all across the developed world over the course of a decade. And it's not like you hear people say, you know, well, France used to be a great country and then they took in a load of Cambodians and everything went to shit. You know, I mean, it was an entirely successful thing. And it was so strange that that's been forgotten. You know, that we've done these things at considerable scale before, not that long ago, and yet it's gone into a sort of amnesiac. Maybe it's a Eurocentric thing because it didn't happen in Europe, nobody cares. But that thing about starving, desperate people fleeing for their lives over water is that, you know, I've seen that firsthand.
Mm. I also wonder whether it's a sort of, these feel like some of those numbers that sound big, but they're actually quite small.
2.5 million people resettled isn't a small number. I agree it was over a decade, but it's still 250,000 a year. And of course, it wouldn't have felt like that if you'd spent the better part of that decade rotting in a camp somewhere, which a lot of them did.
Mm. So this talk is, I think they call it Reality and Dystopia. And it does feel like, looking at your kind of back catalogue, you have spent the last sort of 10, 15 years writing about terrible things happening to the world. I mean, is this a deliberate choice on your part that you kind of feel compelled to look at the worst things that can possibly happen? Or is it just that it happens that we've been through this moment in political history where you've kind of looked at the crash and now you're kind of thinking about this stuff?
Well, I think it feels to me largely accidental. When I started writing Capital, I started writing before the crash, started writing in 2006. And I thought there was a crash coming, but I thought it was going to be a London property thing, you know, a property implosion. And that, you know, there was a dramatic irony that the readers would know something that the people in the book don't. So that was the premise which I began, that they were having, the people in the book would be oblivious to this thing, and then I figured by the time it finished, something would have gone wrong. And it would
be called that one, right, anyway?
Well, but it was much more global and much more systemic than I thought. I thought it was just, you know, initially when I began it, I thought it was just, you know, a bunch of entitled rich people whose houses had gone down a bit in value and who thought that was the worst thing that had ever happened since the dawn of time. And in fact, it did turn out to be something much scarier, much more global, and much more systemic. And in the course of writing it, I realized that if I was writing about, it didn't make sense to write a novel about London without writing about finance and economics, because it was the force that had changed the city. I wanted to write about the way things had changed and realized that I was sort of missing the main driver of it. Because it literally determined who the people who are next door neighbours were, not in a metaphorical way, it's actually who was living in the next house, that the kind of they'd change, and it's because it was to do with everyone worked in finance. And So I started educating myself about that, reading up on it, swatting up on it, and then the credit crunch happened, and then that turned into a sort of live topic that in some way I think we're still living through the consequences of, unfortunately, you know, a decade and a bit later. Luck is the wrong word. Chance, happenstance.
So I think after Capital, you wrote not one but two books on non-fiction books on financial.
I did, yeah. I finished a draft of Capital, and by that point, because I knew quite a lot about the mechanics of what happened in the financial crisis, I thought it was interesting, and I thought it. A number of things. It's quite interesting to write about because it's structural and systematic story, and there's a challenge to telling those. I was interested by that, trying to make it compelling, you know, how to do it. And also I was worried that after I finished a draft of Capital, I knew I was going to have to go back and work on it a bit more. And I was worried that because I'd actually found out, I knew a lot more about the realities of the financial crisis, that I had to be careful to kind of quarantine it because... you can do all sorts of things in fiction. You know, you can really pretty much do anything you want. There's a John Updike novel that kind of proves it, where the cat called Brazil, where the characters change both race and gender halfway through. And that's sort of, in a way, that kind of proves, okay, it's official, you can do whatever you want. But you can't really explain. Explanation kills fiction. And I was aware of the... I just thought there was a risk that if I went back and needed Capital, I'd sort of have a scene where, you know, as Nigel looked out the window towards the lights of Canary Wharf gleaming in the distance, he struggled to remember the definition of a collateralized debt obligation. and I could sort of feel that was a risk. And so wrote the non-book as a way of kind of quarantining it. And keeping it separate, and then went back and finished Capital. And then after that, I just noticed there was a period where every single thing I was being asked to do journalistically was about explaining something, usually when some horrible scandal or crime or implosion had happened, you know, things like LIBOR, HSBC laundering money for drug dealers, you know, the huge fraud that nearly took down UBS. Everything I was asked was about explanation. That made me think that there was just a big gap that there was too big a gap between the people who understood this stuff and the rest of us, and that there was work to be done to try and close the gap. And I was so struck by the fact that we had this sort of genre of popular science where you can't exactly, you know, you can't do quantum mechanics in the comfort and safety of your own kitchen, but actually there's a number of books that will explain it, and biology, molecular biology, all that, things like that. But there's a kind of bit of a hole in economics and finance, and it's such so important to the way society works. So I felt, you know, it would be helpful to do that. So I wrote a book called How to Speak Money about that, which I now think might have been a waste of time.
There was this sort of whole rash of books around 2010 purporting to explain the causes of the credit crunch. And I read about four or five of them in quick succession, and I really don't retain any information from that. And, you know, I guess my question here is that just me, or is this genuinely it's genuinely difficult to kind of explain and grasp a phenomenon this complicated?
Could be a bit of both. I think also there's a thing about it. I mean, there's a dispiriting component to some of that stuff, which is in a way the kind of bigger story. If you step back a bit, the bigger story is, you know, bad people do bad things and get away with it. Repeat. You know, because there is a lot of the sort of general, the general popular feeling about that period was that, you know, spoilt rich people massively fucked up and didn't have to accept any of the consequences, and we paid for it, and in some respects are still paying for it. And broadly speaking, that's true. And I mean, yes, there's lots of entertaining detail if you like that kind of thing, but actually the kind of big overall story, we kind of get the gist. And that's when I was sort of saying about having mixed feelings about having done more work on that economic thing, that actually in some respects it doesn't necessarily, in terms of explaining the way people live and think and feel, in terms of explaining what's happened in our society since, in terms of explaining where we are now, I think in a way maybe economics is the wrong social science.
So what's the
correct tells you what the insiders think. Tells you what Davos Man thinks. Because Davos Man, they're always sort of going and saying, you've got GDP numbers looking rather good, 2.5. is not as good as yours, 2.7. You know, everyone in your country must be very happy. You know, and actually it doesn't tell you anything. It just doesn't tell you anything about what's really happening.
Well, that's something I found very striking about the kind of official commentary on the state of the economy the last few years. It's like, you can pick and choose to come up with numbers that make it look like everything is fine. But very clearly, if you kind of look at, you know, how people are feeling and how they're actually sort of, how they are responding to this kind of moment, everything is very clearly not fine. So something has gone wrong here.
Yeah.
But there's not a transmission mechanism to kind of get from that to Westminster politics necessarily.
Yeah, there's a profound disconnect between that. Yeah, I mean, one of the ways of dramatizing it, I was very struck by it. When Romney was running against Obama in 2012, he said he'd get his campaign pledge, his ambitious target was to get American unemployment down to 6% by the end of his four-year term. Actually, it was down to 5%. So you think, okay, well, that means everyone in America must have been very happy and very delighted and would vote for the incumbent party again. Well, no, actually, they did the angriest and maddest and stupidest thing any electorate in the world has ever done, ever. So there's something about this, as you say, the numbers don't tell you, and the insiders club don't know, and these forces at work. Obviously, there's no causal link between Trump and Brexit. People don't go into a ballot booth in Wisconsin and say, you know, I hear Sunderland voted Leave. I'm not going to vote for Hillary. But the underlying forces at work do look similar, and you see it in, you know, everyone was so, you know, hooray, Macron, the centrist won. But the Fascist Party got 35% of the vote. That was rather glossed over.
Yeah.
And, you know, leaving out things like Orban, Poland, Italy, Spain, you know, that there's a lot of people feeling blindly furious in ways that the numbers can't really explain.
You say that Trump voters were not motivated by Brexit, which clearly they weren't, but I was actually over there reporting in the run-up to that election, and it was really striking the number of people I would speak to in the little restaurants in sort of rural Illinois or something who would want to know what was going on with Brexit. And that did not feel like a good sign for the state of politics in this country, that people in rural Illinois had noticed and were sort of wondering what it meant for them in that way.
Yeah, no, you want to be known for Harry Potter and red telephone boxes. You don't want to be known for upsurges of violent populist emotion.
I mean, going back to the point about systems, one of the things that's kind of striking to me, both about capital and about the war, is that there are people who initially look like they are winning from the status quo, but as the story goes on, you sort of realize that they are just a different sort of victim. I mean, without getting into the spoilers, you can probably kind of guess which characters I'm talking about in each book there. Was that, like, do you think that that's why, is that another reason this stuff is difficult to dramatize sometimes? Because, like, the people who should be playing that sort of villain role are also kind of just sort of stuck in the same system, even if they're a bit richer on the way.
Well, it definitely interests me to show people's, ethical, I suppose we all have ethical blinkers on one way or another. And I think Orwell said the hardest thing for people to see is always the thing that's straight in front of their face. Definitely I'm interested in writing about that and writing about people who can't see the reality, can't see the realities of the world around them. And Joseph Kavanagh, the main character in The Wall, is someone who doesn't see that it's a sort of semi-totalitarian state, doesn't see that it's a form of slave state, and he doesn't, you know, things happen to change his perspective in the course of the book. It's not static. A lot happens to him, and he starts to see things differently. But he sees things differently because things happen to him. It's not because he has some dazzling moment of ethical realization. It's sort of imposed on him. But I think for the most part, we do take on the coloration of the world around us. Mm.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's something else I really want to ask about the war, which is a little bit left field. But it is a book in which young people are standing on a wall to protect their country from a group of sort of demonized outsiders known as the Others. To what extent is Game of Thrones in the mix here?
Well, it's actually just before we came on stage, John's a fellow Game of Thrones fan, and he...
Yeah, this is the rest of the session.
Outlined a profoundly shocking theory about who's going to end up occupying the Iron Throne. It's too scandalous to unload on you, but he comes from a very strange place about this. Actually, I will tell you, he thinks it's Sansa. I don't know if there's any Game of Thrones fans here, but that's really shocking.
I didn't say I thought it was Sansa. I said that somebody had told me that they thought it was Sansa and they thought it was interesting. Yeah. Anyway, this is dangerous territory.
The people who are laughing at that are literally only going to be thinking about that for the whole rest of the thing. Not directly, though. I tell you what, I came across him saying that. I know he was very influential. Well, just for a start, no is the short answer, because his wall is 800 feet high and it's made of ice and magic. And my wall's 15 feet high, and it's made of concrete. So they're kind of different. George R. R. Martin has talked about being influenced by Hadrian's Wall, and I've always loved Hadrian's Wall and been very moved by it. And there's an Auden poem about Hadrian's Wall and about the life of the guards on it and about how far away from home they are. And the funny, interesting thing is that the archaeology, as we know more and more about the actual archaeology of who was on Hadrian's Wall, we keep finding basically that's true. You know, that they were the legionaries there were from the equivalent of modern day Syria, modern day North Africa, modern day Belgium, and they must have had this astonishingly strong sense of being right on the limit of the known world. You know, gazing into this sort of terrifying void that we now know today as Scotland, you know, waiting for some hairy-ass Picts to come charging and lobbing a spear at them. I mean, that sense of being, you know, on the edge of the known, I've always found that very evocative. I found it very easy to imagine that, you know, that life. And that definitely fueled the wall, the thing about it, because it's a two-year term and they're at mortal peril all the time they're on the wall. Because if one of the others gets over when they're on duty, they're put to sea and become others themselves. I mean, it's a time of immense risk, and they're in this sort of liminal in-between state. And that definitely did come from a kind of... That's always snagged at my imagination, that thing about standing on the... You know, your job being to stand on the limit of the world.
Just while we're on the topic, are you excited about the last season of Game of Thrones? Is this a thing you're thinking about a lot at the moment? I did warn you.
Yes, no, I rewatched it. I rewatched it in training, in preparation, and it was better on a second viewing, I thought. Mm. Mainly because I was, partly because I was stone cold sober all the way through. Because I think the first time I'd often take a break in between episodes and cook dinner and then go back. And that might have impaired my judgment. But no, I think it's a remarkable thing, actually, to have had. And also, I think, crucially, it's like my sons watch anime and read manga. And a crucial thing about the Japanese model for those forms is that it's a story. Whereas the American model is that they're franchises, right? No one living will see the last Spider-Man film. No human being alive will ever see the last Star Wars film. Those are franchises, they're going to go on forever. Whereas the other tradition is actually to have a story that comes to an end. And I actually think it's really important for the texture of watching it. We know that it's actually going to, there's going to be a conclusion, series 8 is going to be the end of it. We will have this complete arc. And I think from the point of view of someone who tells stories, it's very interesting to see the kind of energy and tension and momentum that comes from that. Because quite often when you're watching things, American TV things, you start enjoying it, and then a point comes when you realize they're just going to keep milking it until the dawn of, until Ragnarok. It's going to go on forever and ever and ever. And long after it's jumped the shark, long after it's completely terrible, long after, as it were, Meghan Markle has left Suits, you know, they're still going to be making it, and the kind of life drains out of it. And I think it's exciting to see something that still has that sense of energy and life and cultural relevance.
It's also, people keep talking about it, you know, it gets described as the biggest TV series in the world or whatever, but it sort of is in a whole different sense, in that it is, in a way, it's like a 73-episode movie, or
yeah,
whatever it is. It's not really a serial at all. It is just one story with, like, umpteen different threads in it.
Yeah.
Like, it is kind of all feeding into that hole, and that's unusual.
It is unusual. I mean, the other thing that's unusual about it, the sort of elephant in the room, is actually a dragon. Because, you know, it's interesting that something with a component of fantasy has had such enormous success, because if... I've twice had this experience actually with television. The first one, I remember seeing the first episode of Jamie Oliver, and seeing this person you just lob it in, you chuck it in there, bung a bit of butter on it, and if you churn that to me and something said, okay, A, B, which is it? A, this is universally regarded as completely ridiculous and a low point in the history of broadcasting. B, he's going to go on to be the most famous cook in the world and become richer than God. Which is it? And I'm too old to know, you know, that the answer, in fact, was B. I would have probably thought, hey, no, people would be making skits about this forever. You know, just didn't see it. And with Game of Thrones, you show me the first episode, which I think is brilliant and has this extraordinary ending, which is something you felt you'd never seen on television before. It's about kind of danger to a child. And if you'd said after that, okay, that's going to be a global mega hit, or the HBO have just spent 100 million quid for making a film for you and 7 other nerds who like that kind of thing. So I remember hearing it, Richard Madden, hearing it, his agent had described it to him as Sopranos meets Game of Thrones. Sorry, Sopranos meets Lord of the Rings. Mm. And I immediately knew I was going to like it. The 7 other nerds are going to like it. But it's interesting that it has struck such a chord, and it's interesting that a lot of people have this sort of binary setting for fantasy, that anything with a kind of fantastical component to it, they just can't watch. And it's interesting that it's overridden that. I think it's partly to do with the climate thing in it, and I think it's partly to do with the fact that everyone is in danger. Mm. And I think it's the underlying reasons for its appeal are about precarity, about the fact that no one is safe. I think the idea that a world in which no one is safe is a thing that deeply resonates with this particular moment.
It's interesting you mentioned climate again there, because that's something I've always taken from it. Everyone in it is kind of obsessing about this dynastic war, effectively, when we as the audience know there is a much bigger threat just over there, and it's coming, and it is kind of, you know, it has this sort of climatic component to it, and it's winter is literally coming.
Yeah.
I mean, have you always read that about being about the climate as well, or is?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I also think, To get back to my book, you know,
we must.
I'd rather talk about it, but one of the things that if you think that climate change is the greatest existential danger facing humanity, which I do, I'd much rather be able to deny it and think it's not real, but unfortunately I do think that. We have this obligation to do the difficult thing, to face it. And I think that puts great emphasis on work of the imagination, to make it thinkable, to make it bearable, to make it imaginable as a precursor to calling us to act.
Mm.
Because if we can't think about it, we can't do anything else. We have to be able to face it, because everything follows from that. And I think the thing that's particular about it, the thing that's unique about it, is our societies, our politics are essentially arranged around interests. Interests, class, gender, ethnicity, economic interests, whatever. That's how our politics works, that we call for attention on the basis of our interests, we see each other's interests, and we kind of acknowledge them and reciprocate them. And you know, it's the sort of the three R's. It's recognition, representation, and rights. That's just how our societies work. That's how public life works. The thing about climate change is that the people in whose interests we have to act aren't here. They haven't been born yet.
Mm.
And they're, for the most part, the currently most ignored people in the world. They're the global poor. They're the poor in the global south, who are the ones going to be affected first and worst. And so I think there's an incredibly important piece of imaginative work that we have to do to, in a sense, imagine them into being and grant them rights and then act on the basis of those rights. And I think there's lots of different ways of doing it. I do think it's present in Game of Thrones, and I think it's a really important, that sort of, I think we need to acknowledge that it's a new thing in human history that we're doing that. We're imagining people into being and then being called to action on their behalf. Mm. And that's why I think kind of imaginative component of thinking about climate change is so important.
I mean, something else I found incredibly haunting about the book, to be honest, is the way that Kavanaugh hates his parents. And presumably you mean him to kind of, you know, be typical of the entire generation at that point. Like, you know, the young people who are living in this world absolutely loathe the generation above them for letting it come into being, despite the fact that if you kind of do the maths, then that generation is probably also not really responsible. They've also been stuck with this by their forebears. I mean, were you kind of thinking about, we do kind of have these generational tensions now about, you know, house prices and Brexit and so on. You know, it's much more part of our politics than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, this is kind of, you know, that sort of to the power of 100 or something.
Well, there's a number of things in the book that I thought of as being things that are in the present, stretch forward into the future, and really sort of two main ones, like the sort of economic graph comes up to the present, and then you get dot, dot, dot stretching into the future. And the two dot, dot, dots were, one is climate, you know, carrying on the way we are, we don't moderate our emissions, and the IPCC forecasts are correct, and that's the premise of the book, that's the world. And the other sort of dot, dot, dot line stretching into the future, I did see in terms of trends in our society and politics about turning away from each other, turning our backs on each other, building walls, about, you know, rising nationalism, rising the kind of feeling about ethno-states and us and them and others being who have nothing like us and no claim on us and have nothing in common with us. And in terms of that dotted line stretching into the future, one of the things I did think about was this intergenerational thing, which is so strongly present in our politics in the moment. I mean, in a way that is new, you know, that it's that... It's the thing about, you know, you mentioned Brexit, and 70% of people under 25 voted to remain, 70% of people over 65 voted to leave. And if we're in a, like in a confessional booth, and I want to find out how you voted on Brexit, I'm allowed to ask you one question, I'm allowed one piece of data about you, and I can't directly ask you how you voted, but I can ask one thing. The question that tells me with most probability how you voted is, how old are you?
Mm.
That's a new thing in our politics, to be so polarised along lines of age. You know, the Tories, biggest party in the country at the last election, if the franchise had been restricted to people under 25 to only 18 to 25-year-olds could vote, instead of being the largest party in the country, the Tories wouldn't have won a single seat. Again, that's a new thing, to be polarised to quite that extent. And the thing I imagined with the climate thing, was that these existing tensions are kind of magnified by, in some of these sort of grimmer versions, some of the IPCC versions, this catastrophic change, a world that's, in you know, fundamental respects, uninhabitable, unimaginable, happened within two generations or one generation. And I think there would be this process of very direct blame. You know, just not just, you know, we inherited a broken world, but no, you broke the world. You and your generation broke the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kavanaugh is very angry about it, but I do also, you know, take the other half of your point, which is that, you know, it's a novel. You can do things in a novel that you can't do in nonfiction. And I did also want it to be clear that, you know, Kavanaugh is completely telling the truth about his perspective. That's how he sees it. That's his experience. But it's not clear that he's being completely fair. I mean, that's the thing that you can have, especially in family arguments. Someone says something that's true, but it's not fair. Mm. And I think, you know, whether his poor old parents sitting there at home and they're suburban sofa in the Midlands watching telly, whether they actually had enough agency, whether there's that much they personally could have done, I do think the reader can kind of see it in a more mixed way than Kavanaugh chooses to.
I mean, there's an odd poignancy to the moment where, like, he leaves the house and they put on a film about a beach in secret. And you just kind of get this, the parents are not really, so you don't get that much of them, but there's just this very poignant moment of, like, you know, they are also mourning for this lost world that they presumably saw the end of.
Yeah, and they, I mean, I did think, I mean, I was trying to think what it would be like, and I think you'd have people who thought about the lost world, mourned the lost world, sort of dreamed about it, were still imaginatively, in a sense, inhabiting it, and other people who just can't bear to think about it, just don't want to know. And Kavanaugh's very much in the, you know, as he says in the book, you know, because there are no beaches left in this world, you know, my interest in beaches corresponds to the number of beaches there are left, and there aren't any. And he's rid of the old world. He doesn't want to think about it.
In a moment, we should take some questions from the audience. So be thinking of those, or I will pick on someone. But before we get to that, I should ask, you know, what are you working on now? What's next?
Well, when I started having the recurring dream, I was part of the way through another book. And so I'm going to, my plan A is to go back and see if it's still alive. I can barely remember anything about it. In some versions, I keep hoping I'll go back and look at it and find I have written it. Because that's what I did with my first novel. After I had the idea, I kept thinking I'll wake up in the morning and find I have written it. It tends not to work. It's possible that, because when I had quite a long break from Capital when I went off and wrote Whoops about the financial crisis. And I remember when I first went back to it, I had this awful panic moment when I thought, it's so far away from me now, it's not my book anymore, I can't finish it. And actually, in fact, it ended up being quite useful because I could see things quite clearly and quite coldly. So I hope I have a version of that. If it has keeled over and died, and I can't resuscitate it, I've got another novel that I've been thinking about writing, and I've also been writing some sort of ghost stories and tales of the uncanny. And I might go, and I'm hoping I'll have written enough of those to have a collection, one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And are the same concerns we've been talking about kind of sneaking into those? Or these?
Well, someone did say, someone asked that question, and then it said, you know, do you regard your work as prophetic, and what are you writing next? And I said, blah, 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 ghost stories. And he said, well, that would imply that we're all already dead.
Okay, on that note.
On that happy note.
Who has a question? I believe there is a roving mic, yes. Anyone?
There's one down here in the front.
Oh, there's a lady here, and then the gentleman behind. So if you could hold on for the mic, just 2 seconds, it will be with you.
I haven't read the book yet, but I was wondering, what were the challenges for you as a writer in creating this world of an altered reality, as you describe it?
I saw it as a thing about unpacking a premise, you know, sort of seeing what the consequences would be. So there was a lot of then what, or then what, and then what, and what would that be like, and how would they feel about that, and what would the consequences of that be? And that was an unusual process for me. There was less, you know, imagination in the sense of making another thing up. And in some respects, it was almost more like non-fiction in terms of trying to kind of follow a thread of thought through to the end. It's a narrated book, and the thing about a book where there's someone telling you the story, I've always thought it's any work of fiction. There's a triple question: what's the story? Who's telling the story? And how is the story told? And you have to solve all three of those. And when it's spoken by someone, it's often the tricky stage is you know what you want the narrator to sound like, you know what you want the narrator to say, you know what's going to happen in the book, because I'm a planner, I'm that person. But you can't actually hear them. You can't. And my first book, it's about a crazed foodie, and he says it's a cookbook, and then you actually realise it's a story, and then you realise it's a murder story. That's pleasure. And he's a crazed food snob and obsessive, and also a serial killer. Murders 9 people in the course of the book. When it came out, the single question I was asked vastly more often than any other was, is it autobiographical? and I still, like 23 years later, I still haven't worked out an answer to that. But the thing about him, because I knew what he had to sound like, because you had to believe him when he's talking about food. He says, okay, so that's who he is. He's an obsessive food. And then as it gets darker, you have to kind of believe the darkness. So there was almost like an algebraic formula he had to fill. That's all these different things that his voice had to do. So I knew that, but I couldn't kind of pick it up. I just couldn't hear him. And I spent ages trying to sort of get his voice. And then one afternoon I was sort of sitting at my desk and then had this sentence pop into my head. There is an erotics of dislike. And then there's a paragraph about how dislike has a particular kind of emotional texture of its own. And it was suddenly like it was like tuning in a radio. I could hear it. And after that, it went, you know, that basically the book wrote itself after that. I'd kind of picked up the frequency and I could do it. And so that's the thing with voice books. It's that bit is the hard bit. And in this case, I got it very early because I got the first sentence, which is, it's cold on the wall. And with a voiced book, that the first sentence is often incredibly important. Gabriel Garcia Marquez in 100 Years of Solitude. The first sentence of that, I can't remember it exactly, but it's something like, as he stood in front of the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia remembered the afternoon his father had taken him to see ICE. And Marquez said that took as long as the rest of the book. But by then he got it, he tuned in the radio, and the rest of the book came. And in this case, I was lucky. It's cold on the wall came very, very early. And I sort of, I tuned in the radio station. So I knew that was the main challenge. And it also was one that kind of sort of solved itself very early on.
There was a chap there.
Thank you very much. I was interested to hear your remarks at the beginning about this genre, which has come to be called cli-fi. And it is indeed a genre that is being written about and is being written in, and I think that your book is very much one of those. One of the other things that seems to be happening is that people are looking back at books that have been published in the past and trying to sort of, as it were, appropriate them for this genre. And one book that came to my mind as I was reading yours, which I enjoyed enormously, by the way, was J.G. Ballard's The Drowned World.
Yeah.
And I wondered if, I'm sure you know the book, and I wondered if that was in your mind as well as you were writing The Wall?
Not consciously, though I have read it and do love it. I'm a huge admirer of Ballard. A super weird fact is my godfather was interned in Shanghai with the Ballards. My grandparents were interned in Hong Kong and knew lots of people in town. And I barely knew him, but my godfather, because he's stayed in Hong Kong his whole life. He'd gone blind, but he had someone, a kind of a housekeeper, coming. He had the housekeeper read Empire of the Sun to him. And his line is, I knew Jim, because the father was also called Jim. I knew Jim Ballard. It wasn't a bit like that. Yeah. So I thought it was missing the point about as spectacular, because his parents were there all along. He was missing the point about as spectacular as you can, because the parents' absence from that book is actually what it felt like. There were no adults. The adults had all had gone. I do love the drowned world. It wasn't directly in my mind, but I think my new line on influences, so I've been thinking about it because I've been being asked, is that in a funny way, if you notice them, you take them out. If you catch yourself being influenced by something, you take it out. So in a sense, the only influences in books are ones that you don't know are there, which is a version of a theory that I've heard floated. I don't know if you know this one, about this. The only books you can remember are the ones you haven't read. Do you know this one? Because if you've read it, you have permission to forget it. So it's like if John said to me now, I have to write 1,000 words on Clarissa. I could totally do that. Longest novel in English, epistolary novel, rape culture, proto-feminism, you know, blah, blah, blah. No problem. But if you ask me to write 1,000 words on Tom Jones, which I have read, I wouldn't know where to begin, because I've just completely forgotten it. And the only thing I can remember from Tom Jones is the scene where they erotically eat the chicken, which is from the film. It's not in the book. And I think something like that is true of influences, that the only ones that are there, the main ones that are there, are ones you don't know about.
I think we've time for one more question, if there is one. Yes, there's a lady there.
Hello. You've spoken a little bit about Brexit. I just want to ask you, do you think the effects on the economy are going to be similar to that of the banking crisis or worse?
Well, they could well be, but you know, the thing that's so weird about Brexit, beyond, I wasn't that astonished by the result, because I thought it was always much closer than people thought, partly because it's stupid to ask people a question which is effectively, are you happy with the government? You know. And the EU always loses the first referendum. They lost it in France, Ireland, Denmark, you know. I think the thing that's properly astonishing is, so if you can imagine a version of Rip Van Winkle, 24th June 2016, he says, what happened? And you tell him the result, and he faints. And then he woke up today and says, what happened? And there'd be two ways of answering that question. You could show him 500 printed out newspaper articles about, you know, each one shouting louder than the last one about the amazing development that had just happened that day. That your May says this, Barnier says this, astonishing new development, as, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg does the other. You know, all the other way of answering that would be to say, nothing. And Rip Van Winkle would say, well, no, I mean, just on this, you know, what's the future of the EU's relationship with the UK, our most important economic relationship, our closest partner, our vital security interest? What's happened about that? Just, nothing. Don't know. Search me. And that's the thing that is properly, that's the thing that is the most astonishing thing that I've seen in my adult lifetime in politics and public life, to have that we're actually no clearer knowing. And I think it's a failure of governance on a scale that I just couldn't have imagined. I didn't think the British state was capable of failing on quite that scale. So the answer to your question is, I have absolutely no idea, because I have absolutely no idea where the process is going to end. I mean, it's beyond words bizarre. And a big part of it is, you know, we wait all this time for the most incompetent prime minister in modern British history. And then, like buses, two came along at once.
I lied. We have time. We'll take lady there and the lady there. We'll take them together, I think, is probably easiest at this point.
Actually, let's do it the other way around. It makes more sense logistically. So it was a lady just there. But,
mine is a tiddly little question. The Pepys Road in Capital, is that Pepys Road in Wimbledon?
No, it's not. Okay. I thought that it's meant to be, it's because it's broadly speaking based in Clapham, the book. And Pepys, when Samuel Pepys retired from the Admiralty, he moved to a sleepy village just outside the city of London called Clapham. So it was meant to be a very, it was meant to be a subtle in-joke to the two people in the world who cared or knew about Pepys being in Clapham. And I didn't bother to check, because nothing in there, everything in London is named, or everything in Britain is named after defunct aristocrats who never did anything except sit on their estates and shoot pheasants. I thought there won't be a Pepys Road, of course there won't be a Pepys Road, and actually in fact there are two. There's one in Tooting and there's one somewhere else. So just that's just a straightforward cock-up on my part.
And lady there.
I was wondering if you were actually hoping to influence people's actions at all by your book. And how does one balance a sort of need to scare the bejesus out of them with the fact that nobody wants to listen if you do that? It's as I'm constantly trying to scare the bejesus out of people and they are not interested.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad you asked me that question. As Harold Wilson used to say. I do want that. I mean, I suppose, you know, the simple way of putting my ambition for the book is to be wrong. I don't want this world to happen. I don't want us to end up there. I think we have a moral obligation for it not to happen. But the sequence I was imagining was to try and make it clear what the unthinkable thing we're doing is, to make it thinkable as a way of realizing we have to stop it. And I think we have a moral obligation to be optimistic. I think optimism is very, very important, because if we're pessimistic, we'll despair, and despair will lead to inaction, and inaction will guarantee that this this world of pure horror comes about. But, it would be one thing, if the science said that's what's happening, we're doomed, that would be one thing, but the fact is that's not what the science says. The IPCC conference in Katowice at the end of last year says that we can keep the world to 1.5 degree of warming, which isn't paradise, it leaves the ocean warming for centuries still to come, but even the difference between that and 2 degrees, which was the Paris target, is, as the UN says, that's tens of millions of lives saved from catastrophic negative impacts. Each tenth of a degree has enormous consequences for the global poor, for decades, for centuries still to come. And the science says we can avert the worst of it if we act now, collectively and at scale. And I deeply believe in that project. And I wish that the process of imagining it is a precursor to stopping it. For me, that's the whole point, is to stop it.
I think optimism is a fantastic note to end on. Just a couple of housekeeping points. John will be just outside signing copies of The Wall, I believe. Also, while we're predicting the future, I predict that many of you fine people in this audience are going to go over to the Old Divinity School, where you will see the New Statesman's official stand, where you can subscribe for 12 issues for just £12. And with that, please join me in putting my hands together for John Lanchester.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and produced by me, John Ellidge. If you enjoyed the episode, then please do consider leaving us an iTunes review. It really helps other people to discover the show. And, you know, the more people get listening to the show, the sooner I can achieve my real goal of world domination for the medium of trains. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.